Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York invites you to Be the Informed Patient with the podcast that features experts from Central New York's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Amber Smith. The rate of syphilis infections in the United States continues to rise by 80% since 2018, and news reports say we're recording the highest rate of new infections since 1950. Here to explain what's going on is Dr. Elizabeth Asiago Reddy. She's the Chief of Infectious Disease at Upstate Medical University. Welcome back to The Informed Patient, Dr. Asiago Reddy.
Thank you so much for having me, Amber.
So why are national rates of syphilis rising?
There are a couple of different factors at play here. One of them is reduced condom use, which we've been seeing a trend ever since approximately 2010. And we believe a lot of that has to do with the reduction in severity of illness associated with HIV once we have really good medications to treat HIV. So we saw a peak in condom use in the early 2000s associated with the HIV epidemic. And we're obviously very happy to see the improved treatments and accessibility for HIV care, but that does seem to have been associated with a reduction in condom use that has continued over time. So we're seeing this year over year that people are using condoms less frequently than they used to. Another factor is dating apps. A lot of people are attributing dating apps to a general rise in sexually transmitted infections. It's a lot easier to find partners and potentially easier to find anonymous partners. And it can be more difficult to track down partners and treat people who might have been exposed to a sexually transmitted infection in a situation where people are traveling outside of their hometown potentially for sexual encounters or having sexual encounters with people that they don't know as well. So that's another feature. And, you know, I think as it relates to syphilis in particular, one of the things that seems to have contributed in the last couple of years is that there's a possibility that people are having more open relationships, be that by choice, so with or without their knowledge that their partner might be having other partners. And as a result, there is more of a rise in syphilis now among women, which was not the case for the previous years before these last couple of years.
So by comparison, what's happening with the rates of gonorrhea? Because that's another sexually transmitted disease. Is that going up as well?
Our data for the last year indicated a drop in gonorrhea nationally and a kind of a stabilization in gonorrhea locally. It's a little bit hard to say because the time frame is shorter. So with syphilis, unfortunately, we've seen a pretty steady increase over the last 5 to 6 years, actually even over the last 10 years, whereas the numbers for stabilization or drop in gonorrhea are, it's a much smaller time frame. So it's a little bit hard to say whether or not that trend will hold. For syphilis, one of the things that concerns me and that's unique to gonorrhea is that the testing is different. So syphilis is done through a blood test. And it is not always routinely done as part of a package of tests that might be done when somebody presents for either gynecologic care or with concern that they might have a sexually transmitted infection. So it's important that that be looked for, and it's not always done.
So we've been talking about nationally. Does the national picture look the same in Central New York? Are we seeing a rise as well with syphilis?
We have seen, as I mentioned, a general rise over the last 10 years. There have been some years where it's ebbed and flowed a little bit in terms of the numbers. But unfortunately, we've seen a couple of years where the numbers have risen quite a bit. They might be a little bit down the next year and then they're back up the following year. So the trend is unfortunately one that matches the national trend, which is one of general increase.
I read that the state with the highest rate of infectious syphilis, 84 cases per 100,000 people, was South Dakota. And that state has a lot of wide open spaces. What's going on with South Dakota?
So part of that seems to be related to an excess risk among Native Americans. And there's a large population of Native Americans in South Dakota. So I believe that that's a big part of what's happening in that state. And that's reflective of, you know, we know that sexually transmitted infections obviously are going to concentrate in groups of people who are seeking the same partners. So despite the fact that I mentioned that people are seeking partners online, we still overall tend to have partners that match us as it relates to race and ethnicity. And so there are certain ethnic groups and racial groups that have higher prevalence of certain sexually transmitted infections, and that concentration of syphilis among Native Americans, I suspect that's exactly what's going on.
I know syphilis is caused by a bacteria. Where does that bacteria come from, and how does it infect humans to begin with?
So syphilis is actually this form of treponema, which is the type of bacteria that this is, Treponema pallidum. It really only causes infections in humans. So it's endemic in humans. There are other types of treponemes that infect other species. But Treponema pallidum is unique to our species in terms of the diversity of diseases that it causes or illness that it causes. And it is spread by close contact. And that's another unique feature of syphilis that is a little bit different from some of the other sexually transmitted infections, in that it is very efficiently spread by all forms of sexual contact, including oral sex. And so that is something that some people practice when they are trying to reduce their risk of HIV infections. HIV is not well transmitted through oral sex at all. It's extremely rarely transmitted through oral sex, but that is not the case for syphilis. So what syphilis does in the early stages is that it causes what's called a painless chancre. So that is a wound or ulceration at the site where the infection first occurred. So that's usually going to be on one of our mucous membranes, whether oral or genital. And it has very unique property of being able to shut down the nervous response, the nervous system response in that area. And that causes that sore to be painless. So if you actually see one of these, you could be very surprised that it's not really painful. Occasionally it is painful, but most of the time it's not painful. And so that allows these sores to go unrecognized in the majority of people who are suffering from them. So that is the way that this continues to spread to other people, because they don't realize that they have anything going on. They have a sexual encounter. There's close contact with that chancre that has the syphilis bacteria in it, and that spreads to their partner at that time without them potentially even realizing that they have a problem.
This is Upstate's The Informed Patient Podcast. I'm your host, Amber Smith. I'm talking with Upstate Infectious Disease Chief Dr. Elizabeth Asiago Reddy about syphilis. So beyond this canker, did you call it?
Canker.
What are the symptoms beyond that, or are there any? How would a person begin to learn that they're infected?
One of the reasons that we worry a lot about syphilis is that it is a systemic infection. And that is different from some of our other common sexually transmitted infections. So gonorrhea, chlamydia, even HPV, they almost exclusively live at the site of infection. They very rarely, with the exception of occasional cases of gonorrhea, but they very rarely will spread to other places outside of the site of infection. Syphilis is different. Syphilis is a systemic infection. So once you get sick with syphilis, unless it's treated in that primary stage where that chancre wound is present. So if it happens to be treated early, you may catch it before it spreads to other parts of the body. Otherwise, it within the first, usually probably about 21 days, but anywhere from 21 to 90 days after the initial infection, it will spread throughout the body. It goes to the lymph nodes at the site of infection. And then from there, it goes throughout the bloodstream. It very frequently actually goes into the central nervous system as well. And so we worry about it because it can cause a very large number of symptoms or potentially no symptoms. So we already reviewed that first thing that you might catch or might not catch, which is the chancre. So certainly any ulceration, genital ulceration, that you've not already become familiar with. So for example, for people who unfortunately have herpes outbreaks, they may be very familiar with that particular pattern in their own body. Aside from that, you know, certainly any new genital ulceration would be something that you would want to have a provider look at. But a lot of times, as I said, people don't even realize that that has happened. So that is your primary stage of syphilis. The secondary stage of syphilis is extremely diverse in terms of how it could present. Many people don't have any symptoms at all, and they may pass through that stage without even realizing that anything has happened to them. Other individuals can have a whole range of symptoms that include things as vague as just feeling tired, feeling under the weather, potentially some low-grade fevers or some lymph nodes that could be swollen either at the site of infection or throughout the body. But others can have very serious signs and symptoms at that stage of infection, which could include things like meningitis, eye infections, changes in their hearing due to central nervous system infections, skin rash. The classic skin rash is present on the palms and soles, but it can be present literally anywhere in the body. It can also impact particular organs within the body. The liver is probably the most common one to be impacted during that relatively early stage that we call secondary syphilis. So those are the manifestations of secondary syphilis. That typically is going to last from about 90 days after initial infection through approximately, so if people develop symptoms that are severe, most of the time they're going to be seeking medical attention, right? And those symptoms may not go away until they're treated. If their symptoms are mild, then those symptoms may disappear on their own over the course of a couple of months, and the body kind of hides the infection at that point. Once that happens, the person has entered a latent phase. And when somebody is in a latent phase, it may be usually years before this could potentially come back. And in about 20 to 30% of people, if it's totally untreated, it will come back, and it can come back with very devastating, damaging effects in late stages.
So it can come back years later.
Correct. Yeah.
And you wouldn't necessarily even know that you ever had it or were ever infected, but years later you find out you have it.
Correct. Yeah. So these are reasons why we take this infection very seriously.
So can it be diagnosed with a blood test?
Yes. And that is, aside from a very classic looking chancre, the blood test currently is one of the few ways of diagnosing this. So we used to use something called dark field microscopy. And that is a specific type of microscope setting that can see the treponem bacterium. But that has fallen out of favor. It's rarely used anymore, and it's largely unavailable. We're seeking molecular tests, which it would be a PCR-based test, which obviously we're using to diagnose a lot of other infections. For reasons that we don't understand very well, we do not have as much luck diagnosing syphilis with molecular assays as we would like. So right now, there are some that are available more for research purposes than for clinical purposes. And essentially, what we rely on are blood tests that look at the immune response to syphilis, so antibody tests.
But this blood test, you would have to be, as the provider, you would have to be suspecting that it might be this, right?
This is where some of our challenge is coming with respect to rising rates of syphilis, is we still don't have a perfect idea of who needs to be tested. There are recommendations by the CDC and the United States Preventive Services Task Force. So for people who are men who have sex with men, as well as people who have multiple sex partners, our sex workers, and definitely people who are pregnant because of the elevated risk of passing syphilis on during pregnancy. Outside of those particular groups, we are likely to miss people. And we just don't always know who are the best people who should be tested. And the problem that potentially exists with universal testing is, first of all, it's hard to test universally for anything. And second of all, there are some false positives with these tests. So it just becomes more of a challenge of sorting out what's a true positive versus a false positive if you start to test a larger number of people. So that is where I think some of this comes from in terms of the rise in syphilis, is that we are not testing all of the right people, but because of the challenges associated with testing, we're still determining who are the best people to be tested.
Well, I'd like to ask you about treatment. Is penicillin effective?
Penicillin is highly effective, and it is the de facto treatment for syphilis. We have run into some problems recently in the last couple of years with shortages of penicillin. So the ideal way to treat this is with either one or three shots of penicillin intramuscularly. And it depends on the stage that the person is in, whether they would require one or three shots. And that really does an outstanding job of eliminating the infection in virtually everyone. There are rare cases where we might need to repeat treatment or offer a more intensive treatment intravenously. But in the vast majority of people, that is the optimal treatment. So when we're dealing with a shortage, how do we handle it? We revert to our second line treatment, which is oral doxycycline. And we don't have as good of data for the efficacy over the long run of doxycycline. It definitely is efficacious, but it may be slightly less efficacious compared to penicillin. So it's certainly our preference to use penicillin. There are certain cases of allergy where we need to use doxycycline. And then ceftriaxone is an antibiotic that's in the same kind of general family as penicillin and can be used for people with penicillin allergies. However, we don't have a long-acting version of ceftriaxone. So that complicates its use for many patients, because if we were to use that, we would actually have to have people coming back in every day for doses, which is obviously difficult, inconvenient, and potentially painful since it's an injectable medication.
You're listening to Upstate's The Informed Patient Podcast. I'm your host, Amber Smith, and I'm talking with Upstate Infectious Disease Chief Dr. Elizabeth Asiago Reddy about syphilis. So after treatment, does that eliminate the trouble? You talked about the latent stage. Does that do away with that so the threat is gone?
It does. And I would be remiss to not bring up the fact that part of the reason we know this is because of the Tuskegee experiments, which are horrific experiments that were conducted in the U.S. South on African-American people without their knowledge to see what would happen in untreated syphilis. So this is a situation where, it's one of the many elements that go into mistrust in the U.S. medical system for Black individuals and other people of color, other minority groups. So it, unfortunately and tragically, this is how we know this information, that if people are treated, they do not experience these long-term outcomes. And if people are untreated, they have that, like I said, about 30%, 20 to 30% risk of experiencing bad long-term outcomes. There may be some difference now in modern society compared to a long time ago because of people's general health, and then also because we use antibiotics for a lot of different reasons. So it's, for somebody to reach old age, never having taken antibiotics in the U.S. is becoming less common. So it's possible that someone could be inadvertently treated for syphilis over the course of their lives. But certainly that's not something we would want to take a risk on. And we obviously want to treat people when they need to be treated.
Well, we don't have a vaccine for syphilis yet, do we?
We do not. There has been some effort to work on that. I am not aware of anything that looks imminent. Gonorrhea is another story, actually, just to mention that anecdotally. There is more work on gonorrhea vaccination, and there's some promise with gonorrhea vaccination.
You mentioned pregnancy. What happens if a woman gets syphilis when she's pregnant?
This is very dangerous, and this is one of the things that we're extremely concerned about, because we've had a drastic increase in the number of infants who have been born with congenital syphilis or pregnancies lost because of syphilis during pregnancy. So the most dangerous time to acquire syphilis is in the first trimester of pregnancy, with a close follow by the second trimester of pregnancy. But any time during pregnancy is dangerous. So within the first and second trimesters of pregnancy, the majority of cases without treatment are going to end up being transmitted to the unborn infant or fetus. And the consequences can be very grave, ranging from loss of pregnancy completely to very severe congenital malformations, as well as other chronic infections. So infections of the bone, infections of the central nervous system. And the later in pregnancy that exposure occurs, the less likely it is that significant malformations occur, but nonetheless, the infant can still experience very significant signs of infection, to include meningitis. So the results can be really devastating. and have very significant long-term consequences for the health of the infant.
So does the baby get the syphilis through the umbilical cord or during the birth process?
Either one could occur. When this happens early on in pregnancy, then it's because I was mentioning that this is a systemic infection that has a bloodborne component to it. It would be transmitted directly through the bloodstream throughout the course of the pregnancy from a parent to child.
I see. Now, is congenital syphilis appreciably different from just regular syphilis?
Yeah, many of the same signs and symptoms exist, but they are more severe because, as you can imagine, if these infections occur while body organs are actually still in the process of being formed, such a severe infection can impact the proper formation of those organs. So that's why one of the reasons why the earlier in pregnancy it is the more devastating is because there can be a more significant impact on the actual growth and development of the fetus. Treatment during pregnancy can prevent these devastating outcomes. So it is extremely important to test during pregnancy. And some of the testing recommendations were revamped when we started to see a rise in numbers. And in New York State, it does appear that that has made a difference because New York State, I think, did a good job of getting the word out, and testing has increased significantly. So actually, there should be testing during the first trimester and the third trimester, with an additional recommendation to test during the second trimester if there's any concerns about risk. And most people in New York State have just applied that very liberally across the board and tested three times during pregnancy. I just want to make sure I say that you know, hope is not lost. If you test positive during pregnancy, you should be treated. And that will very significantly help to prevent infection or to cure any infection that might have pre-existed.
So are all pregnant women tested without regard to whether they think they're at risk or not?
Yeah, so that's what I was saying. So the first and third trimester testing was very strongly recommended in New York State across the board, regardless of risk. And then we had this recommendation for second trimester testing, which could be applied depending on the potential risk. And I know at Upstate and many of the community OBGYNs that I've discussed this with, they just decided, I'm just going to do it in every trimester because I don't know what people's risks are. That is the reality. We really don't. And that's kind of what I was mentioning before. We don't always do a good job of appreciating what people's risks are. And so even though it may be a small percentage of pregnant patients who are impacted, then it becomes a very devastating situation if we miss even one of those.
Now, it used to be that the county health department would ask someone who tests positive for syphilis to reveal all of their sexual partners, and then the county health department would try to reach those people and let them know. Do they still do that? Do you know?
That is still done. And it obviously can be a difficult job, but it's very important. So we do ask people to reveal their sexual partners. And, you know, of course, we can't know for sure that all the information we receive is accurate, but overall, the tendency has been for people to be concerned about their partners and to provide us with that information. And the health department does this notification anonymously. So if somebody who has been impacted by syphilis themselves wants to be the person who is telling their partners, that's okay. But also it can be done anonymously through the health department. So somebody might get a call saying, we have been notified that you were exposed to syphilis. And the recommendation is that if that exposure has occurred within the last 90 days, that person should be empirically treated because it's difficult to know whether somebody might be in the window period at that point and not be manifesting symptoms, but have still been infected. Whereas if it's greater than 90 days, then the recommendation is for testing.
Now, someone who learns they may have been exposed to syphilis may panic. What advice do you offer these people?
I think it's better to know and be tested and treated if you need to than to not know. So yes, of course, it's disconcerting and it's information that is not welcome to really anybody. But at the same time, it offers you the opportunity to get the treatment that you need.
Do they need to stop having any sexual contact until they figure out whether they are infected or not?
Yes, that is our recommendation for all sexually transmitted infections, with the possible exception of human papillomavirus, because that is so universal. But with all sexually transmitted infections, we are recommending that people do not have sex during the active phase of their treatment. So until their signs and symptoms have resolved, and we will provide them with information about what we think would be a reasonable amount of time where they would no longer be likely to spread that to somebody else.
If someone already had syphilis, are they more or less likely to get it again, or could they get it again?
They can get it again. There's some information about this from older literature. It's not very clear. There may be some degree of immunity that occurs over time, but it is not, it's definitely not universal. So people can get reinfected, and we follow their blood tests. There are certain parts of the blood test that will stay stable over time, and there are other blood tests that change over time as a result of exposure. So we look at those to try and figure out whether someone might have a new infection.
Well, let me ask you about syphilis in general. Does it occur in outbreaks like every generation, or is it just always present?
It has been largely present over the long run. In fact, if you look at the numbers, you mentioned 1950. If you look at the numbers pre-1950, we had a ton of syphilis going on, much more so than we do now, because we didn't really know how to test for it and we didn't have any treatment for it either. And so once we actually had ready access to penicillin, that was when the decision was made to require people to become tested before they married. And that resulted in a huge drop in syphilis all the way up until about 2013, 2014. So there was a period of time in the early 2000s when there was a lot of condom use going on. And we said at that point, well, we may be able to eliminate syphilis completely because it was so low and it was so infrequent. But unfortunately, that changed pretty drastically. And then we've had these steady increases ever since then. So it has been around, and it's very universal. It's around throughout the world. And there's a lot of historical evidence of famous people who either suffered the consequences of the illness itself or of the treatments, which used to be things like mercury and other poisons.
Wow, interesting. Well, Dr. Asiago Reddy, thank you so much for taking time to tell us about syphilis.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Dr. Elizabeth Asiago Reddy. She's the Chief of Infectious Disease at Upstate Medical University. The Informed Patient is a podcast covering health, science, and medicine, brought to you by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York, and produced by Jim Howe. Find our archive of previous episodes at upstate.edu/inform. If you enjoyed this episode, please tell a friend to listen too. And you can rate and review the Informed Patient podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you tune in. This is your host, Amber Smith, thanking you for listening.